Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "One's mind, once stretched by a new experience, can never go back to its old dimensions." In this podcast, we are proud to present our guests, the world leaders and pioneers in the fields of neurointerventional surgery, interventional radiology, and endovascular neurosurgery. We will bring you through their personal journey and the three cases that have marked their professional career. From the very first to the very last case, passing by the most enriching and challenging, welcome to this original format by Link Online, my first, my last, my everything. Hi everyone, my name is Nantia Sujijantararat, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Tudor Jovin. Dr. Tudor Jovin is a professor and chairman of neurology at Cooper University Healthcare, as well as director of Neuroscience Institute. Dr. Jovin, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Nat.
So, Dr. Jovin, can you tell us who you are and the path that you took to get here?
Sure. I am born in Romania and born and raised. I moved to Germany during medical school, and I transferred my medical school to Germany. So I graduated in Germany. Then I had a quick stint in the UK for 2 years. And then finally, I made my way to the US, where I trained in neurology at Hospital University of Pennsylvania. Then I moved on to do my vascular neurology fellowship for 2 years at the University of Pittsburgh, followed by 2 years of interventional fellowship. I was trained by neurosurgeons because at that time there were hardly any neurologists doing neurointervention, so I was one of the first neurologists who were allowed to train in this field. I basically spent almost 20 years at the University of Pittsburgh. After my training, I sort of became the one in charge of the development of the ischemic side of the neurointerventional practice, and was fortunate to be part of a large network of hospitals that we set up to get all the ischemic strokes in for thrombectomy. That was during the times when, as I call it, we were illegal, because it was way before the randomized trials. I had, obviously, as a vascular neurologist, always a special interest in the ischemic side of neurointerventional, trained to do everything and doing everything, but the focus certainly on the research side has been the ischemic side, thrombectomy, carotid stenting, intracranial stenting, these kind of things. And was fortunate while at Pittsburgh to be part of some of the landmark trials that were published in 2015, the thrombectomy trials. Revascat, I was one of the co-PIs, and then I was part of the leadership of ESCAPE and SWIFT Prime. And then 2 years later, we published Dawn. I was one of the co-PIs there. And it's been incredible to see how this field has grown, both the ischemic and the hemorrhagic side. And after these trials, I thought it's kind of time to do something different and get to focus a bit more on the management side. So I decided to move to Camden, New Jersey, where I became the head of the Cooper Neurological Institute and chair of neurology there. So a bit of a different scope or broader scope of activities, but I continue to practice as a vascular neurologist and neurointerventionalist. Still have some of research projects going on, but again, a bit of a different type of work now in this capacity. So that's kind of been my story.
So your name is essentially a household name in terms of stroke thrombectomy trials. I'd love to hear a little bit more about it and sure. How you built your resume up to this position, how you got to be involved in some of the most pivotal trials in our field.
Thank you. I mean, you know, as I always say, I was lucky to be at the right place at the right time. So the reason I was part of these trials and I built up my career on these trials, or these trials were, if you want, the culmination of my research career, was that I had a great deal of passion for ischemic disease. I did my residency during the times of excitement for IVTPA. That kind of spurred the entire enthusiasm for aggressive approaches to stroke. I could see during my internship and residency, cardiology patients going to the cath lab and being reperfused and doing well with reperfusion. So the obvious question is why it's the same disease, why would we not be able to do that in the brain? Because as much as I was enthusiastic about IVTPA, it was clear that it doesn't work well for everyone. And at the same time, there have been a few pioneers. Camilo Gomez, Adnan Qureshi were the ones who have shown us neurologists that it's really possible to practice as a neurologist in this field. And the obvious target was acute ischemic stroke. And that's right why I went into vascular neurology and then interventional. My plan was all along to start treating acute stroke interventions just like cardiologists treat MI. And at the same time, there was the PROACT 2 trial, which kind of brought some evidence into the field that, yes, it's an approach that makes sense. It was difficult because just the notion of a neurologist to do interventions was something that many people could not fathom. It was more of neurologists were seeing as the diagnose and adios specialty, just a lot of intellectual activity around discussions about what the patients have, diagnosis, things like that. But at that time, there was not that much that could be done about these patients. Of course, things have radically transformed in the meantime, not only in the vascular space, but many people who were practicing neurointerventions at that time could not conceive of neurologists doing this. And at that time, there were actually most of the people doing this were radiologists. Even neurosurgeons were relatively few and far between. So it was difficult to find a place where people were open-minding to training neurologists. That's why I went to the University of Pittsburgh, because I sensed that openness to train people that are outside of the classic pathway. And my intention all along was to focus on the ischemic side of neurointerventions. University of Pittsburgh had been one of the lead enrolling sites in PROACT, and there was a place where these procedures were being done, one of the few in the country, and that kind of was a big attraction to me. I had some incredible neurosurgery mentors, open and endovascular neurosurgery, who have taught me early on that it's the pathophysiology that matters, and each patient has their own individual time window. And my mentor, Howard Jonas, vascular neurosurgery open, had introduced a concept of quantitative cerebral blood flow as guide to treatment with xenon CT at that time. And that sort of opened my eyes to the world of not only treatment for, you know, reperfusion for ischemic disease, but also pathophysiology guided, which was very unusual at that time. And as I always say, my first Dawn patient was a patient that it was 2000, early 2000s, somebody who later on we would recognize as big mismatch. Back then, that notion did not exist. And again, patient was a slow progressor. Again, we didn't have that name back then, but I was taught that, you know, it's the pathophysiology, is how much tissue is at risk that should guide treatment. And there we had this woman who came in with severe neurological deficit, NIH 19, small infarct, big perfusion deficit on CT perfusion, and got treated with TPA. And at 24 hours, the deficit was the same, the vessel was still blocked, but the infarct was still very small. And then at another 24 hours after that, the same story. So this woman was sort of living in a penumbral state. So I went to my mentor, Dr. Jonas, and said, well, is somebody who has still reversible or ischemia or a lot of penumbra at 48 hours? And back then, we wouldn't even dare to go in endovascularly. Said, can you do a bypass? And he said, it's a crazy idea, but makes sense. And that woman was revascularized and did very, very well. So that kind of was my first contact with late reperfusion, if you want. And that it's a case that stuck with me and was kind of, for me, the foundation of, you know, reperfusing endovascularly patients in the late time window. But I was fortunate to be at the University of Pittsburgh, very progressive place, very innovative, very open to new approaches, and also with a large network of hospitals feeding into it. I was also fortunate to have some great colleagues on the neurology side as well as endovascular training, a lot of young and enthusiastic people who also helped the academic mission and supported us in that. We grew a network of acute stroke treatment into probably the busiest stroke center in the U.S. over time, with a focus on aggressive treatment, focus on reperfusion. But not only that, we were also sort of pushing the boundaries, if you want, on everything that had to do with endovascular acute stroke treatment, not only thrombectomy, stents, which we probably do too little of right now in acute stroke, but also things like carotid stenting and stenting for carotid occlusions. We were the first ones to describe that non-tandem occlusions can be opened up, and developed some techniques, aspiration, and also approaches like treating patients beyond the conventional time window. We had, as I mentioned, very robust training program as well, trained a lot of enthusiastic, top-quality young people who then went on and did great things themselves, and that's another great source of pride and satisfaction for me. And, you know, with time, as I said, the place has grown into a powerhouse for, you know, it was also on the ischemic side, but my mission there was to grow the powerhouse on the hemorrhagic side, and my mission was to grow the ischemic side as well, and we did that, I think, very successfully. And then we also were very active in clinical trials. We were part of IMS-3. In fact, we were, I think, third enrollers, and the disappointment was huge when IMS-3 was negative. And of course, like everybody else, I felt that we need to do something to undo that or reverse the damage, because we felt that thrombectomy that we all knew worked so dramatically that we are actually at risk of losing it. So we decided to be serious about randomizing patients and organize trials. Before that, also through one of the international fellows, I got to know the Catalan stroke system well, and I thought that that would be a great place to do a randomized trial because they had everything in place, and I had a great partner there, Dr. Davalos. Even before the IMS-3, we obtained funding from Covidien at that time to do a randomized trial in Catalonia. I was concerned about IMS-3 because I could see that people were picking and choosing patients and treating a lot of good patients outside of trial, and I thought that was a real problem. And Catalonia had this enclosed population with an excellent registry of all patients who were treated with thrombectomy mandated by the government. So I thought it's a great place to actually keep track of how many people are treated outside of trials. So, you know, it was an incredible thing to pull off, to get all the major players to mobilize and be part of and randomize every single patient, agree to that. That was during IMS-3. IMS-3 had not been reported yet. And my thoughts were that probably, okay, in my mind, IMS-3 is going to show benefit of patients treated with IVTPA, but how about the ones who don't meet criteria for IVTPA? We need a trial for that. So that was sort of Revascat was initially meant to be addressing only those patients, and then the local neurologist there sort of convinced me that we should include also patients treated with IV, and was great because when IMS-3 was reported, we were basically ready to randomize patients. We're just ready to get the trial started. So then Revascat was started, and at the same time, there was this movement of desperation to get thrombectomy trials to be positive, because after IMS-3 being negative, we were all concerned we're going to lose the field, and Swift Prime and Escape got started, and we were lead enrolling sites in those trials as well, and part of the steering committee had frontline look of how these trials were designed and participated in that. And, you know, we were very disciplined in enrolling patients. That kind of opened my eyes, of course, to the power of randomized trials and the power of, you know, sticking to the protocols and being serious about enrolling all these people and making sure there's consecutive enrollment and things like that. And of course, in 2015, we had all these incredible time of excitement because of the five trials that were published, and the results became known within a space of 6 months of each other. And that has changed everything. I remember how it started with Mr. Clean. I was with my daughter at a tennis tournament somewhere in central Pennsylvania. I got an email saying, oh, you've heard of Mr. Clean. It's a positive trial. Was presented at the World Stroke Conference in Istanbul. And I realized that that's going to affect everything that I did from then on. So before that, also around the time, or even maybe even a bit earlier, we started planning for Revascat. I was talking a lot to Raul Noguera about what do we do with these patients being in the extended time window. And we already had treated a lot of patients at UPMC. We had put together from other centers as well cases that were treated beyond 8 hours, which back then was kind of, you're crazy, how can you do that? And we're able to show that the hemorrhage rates are, because that was the big concern at that time, that we're going to cause a lot of hemorrhages. And we showed that hemorrhage rates were not higher than those seen in the early time window. So at the same time that we were planning Revascat, me and Raul started talking very seriously about getting a trial for patients outside of the 8-hour time window, which then became 6. And the difficulty there was to get any kind of funding agency, whether it's NIH or industry, to buy our story. You know, we went to multiple places and people just said, you're crazy, this doesn't work. And even if it works, there's not enough patients, that those patients don't exist. And it's been a struggle. And of course, the selection criteria were something that we discussed a lot, what would be the best and how. And, you know, we settled on this clinical diffusion mismatch. One of my regrets, if you want, is we had discussed a lot using just aspects instead of DWI or perfusion, but we concluded that even though it makes sense to do that, to use that as a selection criteria, probably no site would be willing to treat patients just randomized based on an aspect score. So then finally we said, okay, let's use automatic, you know, volumetric, rapid-based volumetric assessment. And finally, the Concentric company, which then was subsequently bought by Stryker, agreed to fund trial. And then when Concentric was bought, Stryker took it over and agreed to honor that commitment. And that's how we got to do Dawn. After 2015, 2 years later, we were able to show that reperfusion up to 24 hours works, and works as strong, if not stronger, than during regular time windows. So obviously, that was another big breakthrough. I think one of the reasons why I got involved with these clinical trials was my frustration that even though, you know, I could see as a treating physician how powerful this treatment is, you had this Lazarus effect on people. Didn't happen all the time, but it did happen. And yet most hospitals in the country were not treating, not believing that this treatment works. I was convinced that only randomized trials will change the attitude, would change practice, would change a physician's attitudes. So that's why I've been, and I could not see any other way in terms of making this procedure standard. It's a bit different when you deal with neurologists who are, there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, neurologists in general are addicted to data, to level one evidence. That's a bit different than areas where patients are controlled by surgeons, where the level of evidence doesn't necessarily, traditionally, doesn't have to be that strong. And I knew, just dealing with neurologists, as a neurologist myself, that's what it's going to take to make this procedure the standard of care, and nothing short of that. So that's how I really got to be involved in running these trials, sort of, especially after IMS-3, it became a sense of urgency, a sense of really we could lose this field. And now I will talk about it here at this meeting. Around 2015, I started thinking about basilar occlusions because all these trials, none of them actually addressed basilar occlusions, and we know how terrible that condition is. And so I got to meet a neurosurgeon who is just focused on ischemic disease treatment endovascularly in China, a large place where I thought there's going to be enough patients to conduct a trial that examines the benefit of thrombectomy for basilar occlusion. I did not think it's possible to do it anywhere else other than China because of many reasons, equipoise and it just the sheer volumes. And so I partner up with Professor Zhi in China, and we just presented the results of a randomized trial of basilar occlusion, a bit of a dawn for posterior circulation. A couple of months ago, when we found out the results from an interim analysis, were delighted to hear that the trial is positive. So that was the third, you know, randomized trial that I was a co-PI on. So that's nice. We'll need to see it published, of course, and I'll present the results here. They were presented before at the European Stroke Conference earlier. I think, you know, it's incredible to see how the level of evidence has evolved and has been generated in this field. Still a lot of work to do. But as I said, I was lucky to be at the right place at the right time. And it was all the passion, if you want. What drove me was really, I think, first and foremost, the passion to make people better in a condition that was clearly just with a dismal prognosis. And I could see that this treatment, just based on my own personal observation, helped. And it was a matter of how do you convince the world that that's the case.
And just to be clear to all the listeners, to timestamp this recording here, we are doing this at LINC Paris Conference, and today is May 31st, 2022, and the reason I have to say that is because someone might listen to this a couple of years from now, and, you know, this might be a big trial that came out, and they'd be like, of course, we're doing thrombectomy for basilar. What are they talking about? There are just so many things to unpack from what you said. But in the interest of time, I'm just going to maybe make a few comments. You know, as somebody who is training in today's world, I have the luxury and the ignorance almost of seeing thrombectomy as nothing other than something that, of course, needs to be done and can be done in just a few minutes sometimes. And it's always fascinating to hear person like you, the leader in the field, who's been there from the very beginning and see the struggle of having to push to do it in the first place and then having to do it with the tools that allow you to do it in, you know, an hour or 30 minutes to now.
Back then in the old days, acute stroke intervention was an all-nighter. You know, you went in at midnight, you got out at 4 a.m. because you were working hard to get that vessel open. And right. Now, you know, in half an hour, you're done. You can go back to bed. You got up to go at night for a thrombectomy. You could not count on going back to bed.
And it's fascinating, even despite that, you're pushing to make this through.
Yeah, once you see, you know, it's enough to see a Lazarus effect, then you become addicted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that feeling. I mean, there's very few things that are so satisfying in this profession than, you know, seeing an acute stroke patient, an NIH of 20, going to an NIH of 2, you know, in front of your eyes.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you about one more thing before we move on to the last questions of the segment of the podcast. You mentioned briefly stenting for acute stroke, which I assume you are alluding to, ICAT.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, not necessarily. Okay. ICAD and stubborn clots, you know, sometimes we can't tell. I mean, we think we know what is ICAD and what isn't, but we'll many times we're surprised. And, you know, as I always say, it may not matter, you know, if it's just a clot that is stubborn, instead of keeping trying 20 passes or whatever, you know, just do one or two passes. If it doesn't work, drop a stent. And there's still the stent is still the best and fastest way to open the vessel.
And just because, you know, as of right now in 2022, there's still a lot of debate around ICAT and where we're going from here on. If you have to put a stake on where we're going to be in 5 years, or let's say 10 years with ICAT, where do you think it would be?
I think we're going to stent these patients. And in fact, Bao Chu, the Chinese trial that I mentioned, we used solitaire AB stent, which is detachable. It's available in China. So some of these patients who had ICAD, because in Asian populations, ICAD is very prevalent, in a good chunk of these patients, I'll show the data tomorrow, the solitaire stent was detached. You had this option of actually not only use it as a stent retriever, but also as a stent. And, you know, whether that's, I'm a big believer in balloon-mounted stents, or, you know, which kind of stent, what type of stent will turn out to be the best. But, you know, it works in cardiology, it works in other vascular territories. I don't know why it wouldn't work in acute stroke. And I think the key will be to, number one, understand the nature of the occlusion, and number two, not insist too much with thrombectomy and move to a stent early.
Yeah, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, when people talk about ICAD and balloon-mounted stent, I'm sure you hear this comment all the time about how difficult it is to navigate that through the cavernous segment of the ICA. And I often think, you know, that's what we used to think, too, for direct aspiration catheter. And look at the technology that we have today. So yeah, that might be the case 5 to 10 years from now.
Well, I mean, I think that the intermediate catheters have revolutionized the stenting and especially balloon-mounted stent. Well, it revolutionized the entire field in terms of support and our ability to get the hardware that we need to get to target lesion. But that applies maybe more than anything to stents in the brain because Sampras, for instance, was done without intermediate catheters. And I think a lot of the problems that were derived from Sampras were just, you know, lack of a good support system. And so, you know, if you can get a 6 French catheter in the MCA, which we do that routinely now, then you can get a balloon-mounted stent there because it's much easier now to do it through an intermediate catheter. So I do think, you know, Sampras was good in the sense that it told us that you can't just shoot stent. It's not that simple, basically. That was the lesson, right? And now we have to show that, yes, we learned the lessons and are designing trials and devices that are better and are going to show benefit because the natural history, even with best medical therapy, is not that good.
Dr. Jovan, so we're going to move on to the last segment of the show. We're going to talk about the 3 cases that have marked your career. So the first case is basically the first case that you remember in your interventional career.
The first case that I remember, I think I already mentioned, it was not an interventional career. It was not an interventional case. It was a reperfusion case. I have many cases. And in general, the cases that stuck with you are the complications, as you probably know. And I would venture to say it applies, because it applies to everybody, right? So you tend to not remember the good cases necessarily. You tend to remember the bad cases. I mean, of course, the first case I remember in the interventional world was my first angiogram that I did on my own. That's a big milestone. And then, of course, the first thrombectomy that I did on my own. But in terms of the outcomes and things like that, there was nothing special, you know. I don't necessarily remember the case itself, but you know, one case that I remember was relatively early on in my career as an interventionist was a man who came in a coma with a basilar occlusion, and we treated him. I don't remember what we did, thrombolysis at that time, early days, Mercy, probably Mercy device with thrombolysis. And then we opened him up, was intubated. And then we found out that, you know, after the procedure that he had severe cardiomyopathy and was on the transplant list for a heart transplant. And, you know, when people have a devastating stroke, they're off the transplant list. And the following day, he actually was moving all fours, still intubated, following commands. And I was thinking, what a shame this man is not going to get his transplant because he had a stroke. And who knows, maybe he could have done okay. And a few hours later, the CT surgeon calls me saying, look, it just happens that there's a heart that became available for this man. Do you think there's any chance or that he would have a reasonable chance for a good outcome? Because I'd hate to not offer it. He was 50 years old or something like that, the patient. And I said, look, I mean, he's moving everything, he's following commands. I don't know how much stroke he has. I don't know how he's going to do, but I don't see anything that would guarantee a bad outcome. So please go for it. That's a thrombectomy for basilar occlusion. And then less than 24 hours later, a heart transplant. And I saw him in my office 10 years after this memorable day. So that's a case that stuck with me.
Wow. So you just answered the second question too. That's an amazing case. So the final case. Could you walk us through the last case that you did before you came here today?
Yes, I can. So it just happened. It's the disease that I'm very intrigued by, and I've been sort of fighting it for a long time, and I still don't know what the best answer is, but I do think that there is a role for endovascular therapy, which is the occlusion of the symptomatic ICA occlusion that is non-tandem, right? And these patients tend to present a bit more insidiously. They don't have these giant neurological deficits that the tandem occlusions have. They present over days, and the key is to figure out who is the one that is at risk, because probably not all of the acute ICA occlusions need to be revascularized. But on the other hand, I do think that a subset is a bad prognosis. So the key is to identify those patients. So this patient, I think, is 79, and he came in with mild deficit and had on CTA occlusion of the carotid at the bifurcation extracranially. And we do an angiogram on all these patients because we have found that about 10% of the cases, the vessel is not occluded, at least 10%. And it's a critical stenosis, and you can actually vascularize it. So we brought the patient to angio, and he did have a bit of both. There was a tight extracranial stenosis, but there was a trickle of contrast going up, but I would stop in the cavernous carotid, which is a bit unusual. There was good cross flow from the other side. So I decided to explore to the vessel to see whether the vessel is open all the way through and it's just a flow phenomenon. You can't film late enough to still see contrast going up to the brain, or whether there's actually a second occlusive lesion. And that's some sort of standard for these kind of lesions. For the ICA occlusion, I always explore the vessel because you want to make sure there's nothing more distal that can go up to the brain. And that's usually done very safely with a microcatheter injection. You know, you go distal to the occlusion, you give a few puffs in the cavernous carotid, petrous, whatever, and you clear it. You make sure that there's no thrombi distal to the occlusive lesion proximally. And then 90% of the times, that's what you find. And then you stent the vessel. But here, I was in the cavernous carotid with a microcatheter and occluded. And, you know, I gave a gentle puff as usual. And then I do another run, a gentle puff with another run through the microcatheter. And now there was a clot, basically, that migrated to the supraclinoid ICA. And patient had no change clinically. So I went to the other side again, to the left ICA, to see whether the MCA is open. And it wasn't. So that clot migrated. So back to the right ICA, stented and then aspirated clot from the M1. Within half an hour, the flow was completely restored, TK3. And luckily, this patient was a slow progressor. He just immediately after reperfusion, he went back to his baseline, which was an NIH of 1. So patient did very well, but it was a lot of, it was nerve-wracking. It just happens that was my last interventional case before coming here. But I think that's, you know, these non-tandem occlusions should be investigated in a randomized trial. But we need to figure out who are the ones who benefit most from it.
And now the last question. What do you hope to leave as your legacy in neurointervention?
I do think that with these randomized trials, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to leave a legacy. The other thing I think is all the wonderful people that I trained or helped train, that's another thing that I think is a legacy that you leave behind. It's really a major contribution that you make to this field, and it's something I'm very proud of. It's one of the most satisfying things in one's career. And so I think these are the legacies I'm leaving behind. Again, I was lucky to be in this field at a time of incredible developments.
And if anyone wants to find out more about you or what you're doing at Cooper University, what would be the best way to follow your journey?
Well, I have a Twitter account, so they can look that up. And, there's a website and there's some information there as well. And they can always reach out to me, email or Twitter, or there's ways to do that. And I would welcome that.
And the Twitter handle, I believe, is your first and last name.
With a G with my middle name as well.
Ah, yeah. Tudor G.
G. Jovin.
Jovin, yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Jovin, for your time today.
Thank you very much.